From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, Oscars got a new boss. The new president of the Motion Picture Academy talks about its future. Then, a new documentary that features Geena Davis calls on studio executives to do more about gender discrimination in Hollywood.
We have unconscious bias. So we have to realize we have it. You cannot say, I'm hiring based purely on merit because I'm that woke, you know, because you're not.
And musician Ty Siegel gives us a taste of his latest album, which is titled First Taste. All that coming up on The Frame. Casting director David Rubin has been elected the new president of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. Among the issues facing the Academy right now, the diversity of its membership, the changing landscape of film distribution, and the delayed opening of the Academy Museum. We started with how casting directors like Rubin can improve diversity in Hollywood.
I think casting directors have been at the forefront of the diversity movement in terms of who appears on screen. One of the things that most casting directors, and I would like to think all casting directors, do is look at a script and begin to open up the possibilities by, in many ways, ignoring what a screenwriter has written in terms of the specifics of that character, their gender, their age, their race. A casting director really should focus only on how that particular character factors into the narrative.
So that's your job as a casting director. Now your job as the president of the Academy. How can the Academy, even though it doesn't make hiring decisions, start to help change the conversation in Hollywood about who is and is not offered work?
Part of it has to do with using our relationships with the people at the studios, major production companies, and the filmmakers, and engage them in that conversation. The other way is, in the reverse, because we've now admitted many diverse women and people of color and people internationally to the Academy, the profile of those people, the relationships that will be forged through their Academy membership will, I believe, open up opportunities for them. So I think it's sort of a two-pronged attack. The other thing that we're doing is through our Academy Gold internship program, which is directly focused on young, diverse college students who spend the summer in Los Angeles interning at various studios, production companies, agencies, casting offices.
Before I came to KPCC, I was a reporter at the LA Times, and I and a group of reporters at the paper spent about a year investigating the membership of the Academy. We released our story in 2012, and it certainly found that the voting membership was heavily white, male, and old. And the Academy has really expanded its membership since then. Where do you see the growth of the Academy going? Because in the last month, the Academy added more than 800 people to its voting ranks. What's your thinking about that?
My mind has mostly been on the nature of the new members rather than the number of the new members, because if someone is qualified, and I think we have to maintain very specific and very stringent qualifications, and each branch determines their own. In some cases, I think those branch qualifications might be tightened still, but for the most part, they're very specific and quite demanding. In addition to that, each branch has an executive committee that evaluates all of the applications for membership and also explores others that have not applied for membership but who have emerged as qualifying people that we then approach about possibly applying for membership.
We're talking with David Rubin, who's the new president of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. In 2017, you led a task force on the issue of how the Academy should respond to the behavior of its members. And the Academy has kicked out a number of people, including Harvey Weinstein, Bill Cosby, and Roman Polanski. What kind of system does the Academy have in place for investigating possible violations of its code of conduct? Why is this important, and where do you think the Academy needs to go in the future to deal with either past or future incidents?
The most important thing is that there be a mechanism for people to report alleged incidents of breaches of our standards of conduct. And that is available to Academy members and non-members alike on our website at oscars.org. But the Academy itself is not an investigative body. And we do refer things to a law firm that we've engaged to help us adjudicate and assess the severity of a claim and the substantiality of a claim.
You are assuming the presidency with a couple of big issues kind of percolating through the academy right now. I'm going to deal with one of them, and that is whether or not the rules need to be changed for what is and is not eligible. And it came up in this year's Oscars, I think, really tied to Roma. Steven Spielberg raised this question of whether or not movies that debut on a streaming platform like Netflix and in theaters at the same time should be eligible for an Academy Award. What's your thinking about that?
The board made a determination this past year to hold with our current standards regarding theatrical distribution and vis-a-vis streaming, and I stand by that. The truth is that I think this needs to be an ongoing dialogue because the landscape is constantly changing. And what my hope is that I will be able to bring together all of the best and brightest, Academy members or not, who have skin in the game or involved to any extent in distribution and production, and to sort of sort out what is a motion picture and what are we honoring.
The director of the Academy's museum recently announced that he would be leaving. The museum has been delayed. There have been some cost overruns. What is your hope for when it will be done? And I guess even equally important, why is it important to the mission of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences?
Well, the mission is so focused on celebrating the art of motion pictures, recognizing excellence, and preserving the past. And all of those things are very tied in to a motion picture museum, which amazingly has never existed in Los Angeles. We've hired a preeminent architect, Renzo Piano, who's designed an amazing edifice that's near completion. And truthfully, the focus and the priority is quality and a sense of telling the full story about motion pictures, past, present, and future.
David Rubin is the new president of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. David, congratulations, and thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks so much.
Coming up on The Frame, more about Hollywood and diversity with Gina Davis and what didn't happen after Thelma and Louise.
Friends are warmer than gold. You're old. Keeping them is harder than you might suppose.
Gina Davis has made a career out of playing roles that quickly become feminist icons. Thelma in Thelma and Louise, Dottie Hinson in A League of Their Own. And while we have yet to have a woman president, Davis brought one to life as Mackenzie Allen in the TV series Commander-in-Chief.
You can't talk to me like that.
Well, I can't tell you the truth.
It's inappropriate and makes the staff uncomfortable.
Oh, come on. I didn't say anything that any one of them wasn't
it's
thinking.
It's not what you said, Rod. It's how you said it.
But the overwhelming absence of quality female characters in Hollywood inspired her to launch the Gina Davis Institute on Gender in Media. So it makes sense that she's an executive producer of the new documentary This Changes Everything, about the fight for gender equity in Hollywood. Davis says she's made it a mission to shine a light on how women and girls are portrayed in popular culture because not enough has changed for women since her 1991 breakout role in Thelma and Louise.
Where do you get off behaving like that with women you don't even know? Huh? Huh? How'd you feel if somebody did that to your mother? Or your sister? Or your wife?
Huh? What are you talking about?
You know good and damn well what I'm talking about.
I mean, really? That business with your tongue? What is that? That is disgusting.
When Thelma and Louise came out, it was really fun to be in a movie that struck a nerve like that. And all the press was talking about, now everything's going to change. This movie was such a phenomenon that there's going to be so many more movies with women leads or female buddy pictures, road pictures, whatever. And so I was like, wow, that's fantastic news. And then the very next movie I made was Leah Their Own, where the reaction was, now there's going to be so many female sports movies. This proves once and for all that people are craving female sports movies. And then I grew cobwebs waiting for that to happen. And it also, after Thelma and Louise, every single interview I did seemed like they would ask, are things better now? Things are better now for women, right? And at first I'd say, yeah, I think so. Sure seems like it. But soon enough, I realized it wasn't the truth.
There is the moral argument, like this is what the country looks like and this is how it should be presented. There's the economic argument. This is how well these things do when there are diverse casts and diverse filmmakers. But then there's the impact argument. And I want to talk about a clip in the documentary where you're talking about how images of women in TV and film really impact young women and girls.
Images are so powerful that it will impact real life. In 2012, my archery coach noticed that when both Brave and The Hunger Games came out, suddenly the percentage of girls taking up archery shot up 105%.
This is called, I think in the documentary, the CSI effect, and that's tied to how many women entered forensics after all of the CSI shows. And I think it's important to recognize that if you can't see yourself as something on screen, you can't imagine yourself as that person on screen.
We don't have enough real-life role models. If we were seeing women be presidents and important people, and if half of our CEOs of Fortune 500 companies were women, we would see that, and then you'd say, oh, I realize I can be that too. But we don't have enough female role models by any means, and so it's vital to see them on screen because life really does imitate art. We just did another interesting study on the Scully effect. Fox asked us to try to measure the impact that the Dana Scully character from X-Files had on women.
If it was natural causes, it's plausible that there was something missed in the postmortem. If she was murdered, it's plausible there was a sloppy investigation. What I find fantastic is any notion that there are answers beyond the realm of science. The answers are there. You just have to know where to look.
It turns out 63% of women in STEM fields cite Dana Scully as their exact role model, the exact person that inspired them to go into those fields.
So there's the thing about like seeing yourself in a career or as an independent person or as somebody with agency. And then there's the other issue, which is the way that women and young girls are sexualized on screen. Do you think that that is just as much of a problem or maybe even a bigger problem than it is about the kinds of roles that women get to play?
Oh, well, yeah, I would say it's at least an equal problem and a very important one because we're teaching women that their value is how they look and how they are perceived. A study recently showed that girls as young as 6 now are self-sexualizing. They have learned by 6 to see themselves through the male gaze and judge themselves that way. So it's a huge problem. And our research also shows that sexualization of characters is going up, in fact, if anything, as bad as it already was. Now, female characters from 13 to 39 are equally hypersexualized. So it's getting younger and younger, too.
We're talking with Gina Davis about her documentary, This Changes Everything. So it's hard to figure out the systems in place that need to be changed, but there are systems. I think you describe it in the film as a spider web of who knows whom and how agents talk to producers who talk to studio executives. How does that cycle start to break apart? And where are the weak links that maybe people like you and who are like-minded start to look to try to interrupt the cycle as it is right now?
Well, I think it's important for all of us, men and women, to realize we have unconscious bias because we were trained to have it from the beginning. So we have to realize we have it. You cannot say, I'm hiring based purely on merit because I'm that woke, you know, because you're not. You know, there's all those studies like Yale did a study that showed if you send out two identical resumes, one with the woman's name, first name, and then one with the man's first name, and every other way identical, the man gets more job offers at a higher salary. And the people say, sounds like somebody I would like, and the woman not so much, and, you know, less money and less offers.
It's hard to get a career going unless you have a job, and it's hard to get a job unless you have a career going.
Absolutely. It has to be a decision that we're just going to do this. Like Ryan Murphy, you know, started his initiative called Half, and he decided, I'm just going to do this. Half of my crew is going to be female and half of my on-screen characters, and you can do it.
Over the last 5 years, I think in particular, there have been an amazing amount of studies. And the data, year to year, doesn't really change, but there is a trove of information now. And I'm wondering, how do you think that has or has not changed the nature of the conversation about diversity and representation?
When I started my research institute about 15 years ago, my whole idea was to try to impact on-screen representation through research, because when I first noticed how few female characters there were in kids' movies and TV, it was because my daughter was a toddler and I started showing her preschool shows and kids' videos and things. And I was horrified to see that there were far more male characters than female characters, because we're saying very clearly, boys are more important than girls, men are more important than women. So whenever I had a meeting in the industry, you know, with a director, a studio exec, whoever, and I'd say, have you ever noticed how few female characters there are in movies made for kids? And every single person said, no, that's not true anymore. That's been changed. That's been fixed. And before the data, they had no idea they were leaving out that many female characters. So we've yet to leave any meeting where somebody hasn't said, you just changed my project, or you just changed all of our projects.
There's a lot of talk about hiring women, both in front of and behind the camera. At the end of this documentary, directed by Tom Donahue, shot by a man as well. So I guess I'm going to put you on the spot and say, explain.
Yeah. Well, it was his idea to make this film and raised all the money himself and hired himself, you know, to shoot it. And I came on board about 2 years in. He had already been shooting it for a couple of years and then heard about my research institute and asked me to come on board. So I was thrilled to, you know, I thought it was great.
A lot of the message of the movie is that change starts with you. Who is the you? Because you tried to talk with studios. They didn't want to come on camera and talk about it. So who is that you? And if the studios had agreed to be interviewed, what would you have asked and told them?
Well, I talk to them all the time, actually. You know, my whole thing is to meet directly with the decision makers. Instead of trying to educate the populace, in other words, I can go directly to the people creating all this and share it in a private and very collegial way. And they're very responsive. I think, you know, in a case like this documentary, you might not want to, I can understand not wanting to get kind of publicly busted. I could see that. But they are definitely working on it. I mean, look at Disney, how well they've been doing. They now make more movies starring a female character than not. And Bob Iger just announced recently that 40% of their upcoming movies will be directed by women, as opposed to the 4% of the rest of the industry. So they are, like Ryan Murphy, making decisions that we're just going to do this, which is great.
Gina, great to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much.
That was Gina Davis. The documentary This Changes Everything is in select theaters starting August 9th. Coming up on The Frame, rock musician Ty Siegel has a few surprises on his new album. It's Thursday, so if you subscribe to our weekly email newsletter, check your inbox today. If not, you should sign up now at theframe.org/newsletter. It's a great way to keep up with your favorite culture show. And now the prolific rock musician Ty Siegel is back with another new album, but this time it's a little different. It's called First Taste, and it was written and recorded without a single guitar. Instead, Siegel used instruments like the koto, bouzouki, and mandolin, among others, to piece together his newest record. He stopped by our studios in Pasadena and spoke with KPCC producer Itzy Quintanilla about the creative process behind First Taste.
I often make records that have like a rule where I'm not allowed to do something. And this was, I'm not allowed to play the guitar. I was constructing songs kind of piecemeal, chopping them up and making these weird demos, mainly because I usually write a song holding a guitar and then writing the lyric with a guitar. But this was all over the place, kind of big question mark. Didn't know what I was doing at all. to kind of replace the acoustic guitar, I used an instrument called a bouzouki, and it's a Greek instrument. There's also an Irish bouzouki to replace kind of the electric guitar. I used an electric kodo, Japanese kodo, and then I used a bunch of other instruments that I'd never played before. The song Taste started with the drums and then a bass line and then all the instruments afterwards. The lyrics came last, and the vocals kind of followed a weird percussive. I wouldn't say they were an afterthought, but they definitely were the last thing. I really like the lyrics, and I really like the vocals on it, so maybe it works to write the lyrics last. I don't know. Ice Plant was the only song that I had written on a guitar from years ago. It's an old song of mine, and I never really felt good about it. I felt like it was incomplete, and I had one idea, lots of ideas, but one idea I really liked was I have to do the scariest thing I can think of, which is an a cappella song. Let your love rain down on me. Let your love. So that one was really fun and weird and strange. At first, I wasn't going to put it on the record at all because it was too out of my comfort zone. But I think that's why it's cool, because it's so different. I think it's probably the most different song I've maybe done. The interludes, the instrumentals were an exercise in restraint. I feel like I could have turned this into a double album, but I felt like I needed to restrain myself and make a single album. So a lot of those songs turned into little snippets and segues. I just liked the phrase of when I met my parents, because people show themselves differently all the time over their entire lives. And the older you get, the more you get to know people, and your parents are even a part of that, where you grow together and you are different people constantly over time. So I just felt like that was an interesting phrase to throw around. I am a rabbit, and I worship the dog. I'm a big fan of music where the lyrics are a little abstract, little obtuse, hard to fit into a box where you can create your own meaning out of it. I think that's the coolest part about music, is the open-endedness of someone creating their own meaning. You're all alone. There wasn't an intention going into the record about what the lyrics were gonna be, but they ended up being, yeah, a lot more introspective, memory and dreams, family. I felt like at the end of the day, what I thought was interesting is that I think a lot of my songs are pointing the finger at people, but I think this record, it's I'm pointing the finger at myself. I'll be doing residencies at the Terragram in town, where we'll be playing four different old albums from the past along with the new one. Revisiting the old albums is a little weird and strange because I don't like a lot of the songs, to be honest. Not the majority of them, but a few. So I've been forced to learn songs I don't like. But because of that, some of those songs I've actually grown to like again.
Talk- Ty Siegel's latest album, First Taste, is on streaming services now. His Friday night residency at the Terragram Ballroom in downtown LA continues through September 27th. And that's our show for today. I'm John Horn in the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. We'll see you back here tomorrow.